You're listening to the 5 Leadership Questions podcast, brought to you by Ministry Grid. Ministry Grid is an online church leadership and volunteer training platform offering a library of thousands of videos and a suite of powerful admin tools to provide practical training for every area of ministry in your church. Find out more and get a free 30-day trial at ministrygrid.com/howitworks. Welcome to the 5 Leadership Questions podcast. I'm your host, Barnabas Piper. I'm here with Todd Adkins, my co-host. And today we are asking 5 leadership questions of William Vanderblomen, who started the Vanderblomen Group, and he's currently their president. And what the Vanderblomen Group does is they're a search firm and a consulting firm for churches. So they help match pastoral and staff candidates up with churches, and as well as working with churches on staffing and leadership strategies, things like that. William, we are really grateful that you'd take the time to join us today. So thanks for being on the podcast.
Absolutely. Oh man, it's an honor to be here. You guys have done great work so far. I think we launched podcasts pretty close to each other, and it's cool to learn together. I don't know that anybody's an expert on this. You try and find one, and if they say they're an expert, they end up not knowing much.
And yeah, so you mentioned. Oh, go ahead, Todd.
Oh, I was just going to say I've heard from a reliable source that the Vanderblomen Leadership Podcast is kind of the Jimmy Fallon of church podcasts.
We do have kind of an unusual guest list. It's something to offend everyone. I mean, we'll have a charismatic one week and Southern Baptist the next, and then a mainliner. It's kind of crazy, the list we have.
And you mentioned that you guys launched right around the same time we did, and we both followed real similar tracks with a strong launch and great guest lists. And so now we get to kind of return favors. You mentioned that you've had Tom Rainer on. We just recorded an episode with Tom Rainer not too long ago, and so there's all sorts of synchronicity here. We're like a sibling podcast. That's great. Couple other things for listeners about William. He released a book. It was not too long ago, a few months ago, called Next. It's on pastoral transitions. He co-authored that with Warren Bird. That book has some fantastic wisdom in it for church leaders looking at strategies and wisdom for finding the next pastor and how that's worked. So they look at the history of how it's been, who's done it well, and then what are some things that churches should look at. So go pick up a copy of Next if you're in church leadership. That's a really valuable tool. So just wanted to highlight that before we jump into our 5 questions as well.
Yeah, you know, go ahead, Todd.
Okay, I will say one thing about that book, because I did read it cover to cover. I would say it's one of the greatest tools for a senior pastor, a pastor search committee, or someone in the church who just wants to begin to have a conversation about succession. It's a great tool to give people permission to have that conversation, which we all know that in thousands and thousands of churches, tens of thousands of churches across the U.S., that is a very much a needed conversation. And I think it's a great, great tool to do that.
Thanks so much, man. The whole point of writing that book was to legitimize the conversation between a church and a board, because, you know, churches and pastors, it's not the typical employer-employee relationship. It's much, much more like a family, right? And so, you know, in a family, if dad sits down at the head of the table and says, why don't we talk about what's going to happen when I'm not here anymore? Well, half the kids think he's terminally ill. The other half think he's got another woman. And it's not too different with church boards. Is there something wrong with you? Have you done something wrong? What's the deal? But the truth is, we started the book with this line: every pastor is an interim pastor. No matter what denomination, what country, all of us are interims. You're either one of three things will happen at the end of your ministry. Either you'll run your church into the ground and it'll close, not cool, or you'll be the pastor when Jesus returns, very cool. very hard to plan for, or someone's going to come after you. You know, I mean, that's right. Just it. So I'm a recovering preacher, so I'm being long-winded, but thanks for bringing it up. I'm pretty fired up about the topic.
I've absolutely borrowed that line that every pastor is an interim pastor since I saw it in the book, and have used it in a couple different contexts when I've been talking leadership development with churches. And it's something that you always get a a bunch of nods in the crowd, like sort of the, oh, I never thought of it that way before. So that creates a paradigm for people thinking about developing those who come after them. And that's fantastic. So thank you for that, along with everything else that's in the book too. But that line is one that I have used with some regularity. Why don't we go ahead and jump into our five questions? So the same question we ask every guest right off the bat, and it's always a great conversation starter, is who are you learning from right now?
I would say I have been learning primarily from millennials. So our staff, just a little bit of background, we're based in Houston. We've had really robust growth for every year we've been open. So now we actually have about, well, I don't know when we air, that the headcount will change between the time we record and the time this airs, but we're about 35 full-time employees, 34 of whom have moved to Houston to be here in our office. And you've got all these guys that have a ton of ministry experience. So I think we counted it up and it's like 290 years of ministry experience in our consultants, the Tim Stevens of the world. I mean, it's pretty amazing. But then behind all of them, like a surgical team behind a surgeon, there's a support staff and there's a big age bifurcation. And that support staff, whether it's researchers or people who do blogging for us or all kinds of things, they're almost all under 30. And that has been the coolest thing for my personal development, to be around millennials and have them be probably 70, 75% of our office and just see how they function. It's the largest sector of our workforce now, the largest demographic in the U.S. labor force, and nobody knows what to do with them. Anytime I write anything about working with millennials, it gets picked up by Forbes or Inc. or Fast Company or something, because it's like everybody's got one, but nobody knows what to do with them. I think they're fascinating, and they've taught me a ton.
We did a podcast recently with Brad Lominick talking about just leadership differences generation by generation. So just broke it down by millennial, Gen X, and then the boomer generation. And I mean, that is a conversation that is always hard to end, because there's just so much to talk about in terms of the different styles and those kinds of things. So you say you've been learning from them. What are some of the things that you've been absorbing from that, you know, that demographic in your workforce?
Well, I'll tell you one that actually ended up becoming one of our core values. And that is, I'm learning from them that every day of my life, I get less flexible. And I'll flesh that out for you just a little bit. And it's true of everybody. I was on a run. It's probably been 2-3 years ago now. And our youngest one was 2 or 3 years old. And I got home from the run and I was sitting down on the floor trying to do some stretching so I don't get injured, because I'm at that place where I'm not the young guy anymore, but I'm not the old guy. So I got to do the stretching thing. So I'm sitting down just trying like crazy to get my hand all the way underneath my heel. And my little girl walks up and laughs at me and then ties herself into a human pretzel and just looks at me and then gets up and walks out of the room. And I'm like, what? And it just dawned on me that physically, every day you're alive, you get less flexible. Organizationally, every day your organization is alive, it's going to calcify naturally unless you do something about it. And spiritually, and as a church, churches that are first generation can get more done quicker because they're agile. So watching the millennials in our office has just reminded me that they're more agile than I am. And so we built into one of our core values, we actually measure people's performance on their ability to live out their values. You don't get paid if you aren't living out these values. And one of the main ones is ever-increasing agility. So when we hire people, we look for people that are always stretching down, stretching younger. And I think that's going to be more and more important in the years to come. The rate Absolutely. Of change... Yeah, the rate of change is just going to get faster and faster and faster. In fact, I would have said I'm learning from the millennials, but who I'm really learning from now are our interns. And that's the 20-year-old that manages our social media. And I'm going to trust that you guys don't have any listeners that work for OSHA, because my my tweener daughter's volunteer intern, and they may or may not get a free dinner out of that later on. But when they come in...
Just call it Take Your Kids to Work Day.
Let's call it that. When we bring in our 13-year-old to teach our staff how to use Snapchat, that's just cool.
Yeah.
So I think I'm learning to try and get more and more flexible every day, and having the millennials around me is a big piece of that.
I think one of the things that keeps coming up again and again, as we've talked to leaders, one of the cool things about the five questions as we framed them is leaders as lifelong learners keeps coming up again and again and again. The connection between ongoing learning and leading and, you know, continuing to grow and continuing to expand your capacity, or, you know, the result, the other side of it is not good, because I don't think you can get to a place where, you know, 20, 30, 50 years ago, you could specialize in something. You could get the education that you know, the best education out there, and then get a job and you were good to go for years and years and years. That ship has sailed, and it's never coming back again. So as you look at things like that, what's the main point of emphasis for your leadership team and yourself right now to kind of remain agile?
Sure. And I think it goes even deeper than that. It kind of ties back to our conversation about succession. Yeah, these millennials are great, but one of the hallmarks of the millennial generation is they don't stay in any one job for their whole career. So I'm perpetually trying to remind myself, any one of those people could walk in any day and say they're going to do something different. And so I've got to build a system that is not based on personalities. I do have, Bill Hybels, who mentored me far more than I deserve. He's told a lot of people this, I guess, but you ought to have your vomit list, and it's short, and it's the two or three people that if they walk in and tell you they're moving on, then you reach for a bucket and you vomit, and you need to know who those people are so that you're prepared. But beyond that, you need to build a system that'll last. So for us, the main emphasis of the leadership team in building a system that will last is focusing on culture. We don't have a five-year plan. If you'd have told me where we'd be 5 years ago, looking for, I would never have guessed it. We don't have a strategic vision. I mean, we know that God is starting to let churches and ministries find the right person for their team through a different way, and that we get to be a part of that, and it's very humbling. So we know that. But beyond that, we just try and position ourselves for opportunities and have the resources to respond to those opportunities. And the one constant that makes our system sustainable is a pretty relentless focus on culture. Mm-hmm. And I know that's a buzzword right now. It's on, you know, every blog in the world. It's about culture, culture, culture. But it trumps everything. Peter Drucker said, culture eats strategy for breakfast. And I couldn't agree more. So when we're hiring now, we have our 9 cultural values, and we have a 10th that's unspoken, but those 9 values are how we interview. When we interview people, I used to not believe in 360 interviewing, you know, interviewing some people from above and below the person you're hiring.
Right.
But now we do 360 interviewing, and we'll pull the person who at the moment is living in the zone of our values the highest into the interview. And that might mean some 22-year-old administrative assistant is coming in to interview a consultant who's worked in a church for 20 years. And that voice is just as valuable to me, because if you don't match our culture, nobody's going to end up happy. And it's done things like when we interview for us, we give people a list. It's growing, but it's about 10 or 15 reasons why you should not work here. Like, if you're a workaholic, go away. We don't want you. But if you're just inside the line of workaholism, you're going to be right at home. You know, so that's and we put that on the table from the beginning, and it's all about culture. In fact, you know, we do our annual reviews. You got 9 sections, and it's the 9 cultural values and how you work. It's not sales numbers or those kind of things. So, we're a young company, and I've been doing search for 7 years. The company in its form is about 5.5 years old. So, we've got a long way to go, I hope. And when you're young, culture can be tight, but right now it's really tight. We were just voted one of the best places to work in Houston, and I can't claim credit for it. It's that we have culture. So one tangible lesson for me in learning and focusing on culture is that if you don't have a staff person who has as their responsibility driving culture through the organization, then it's probably going to leak, because everybody else is just, it's not going to naturally happen. So we actually have a person on our team who half of their job is, we call it the culture whip. And whether that's fun things
that's awesome.
or thought leadership pieces or gamifying something around one of our values. Katie is on top of it and makes sure that culture is driven through the organization. And it's part of whether she gets paid or not is how well that's happening.
How do you, how did you pick the person? How did you move somebody into the role where that is their, that's one of their primary responsibilities? Was she just the person who exhibited those nine values so clearly? What was it you that made you move her to that position, I guess?
Yeah, that's exactly it, Barnabas. It's the person who exhibits those values. It needed to be somebody who's here too. I mean, our consultants travel all over the world all week long, and you know, they're always here for Thursday and Friday. That's kind of our collaboration time of the week. But it needed to be somebody based here. Need to be somebody that matched the values. And then if you're gonna add that kind of person, I don't know if you use personality profiling at your workplace, whoever's listening, but if you use the DISC, it probably needs to be like an I, you know, an ID, somebody who likes planning parties, you know, and that doesn't mean it's a culture party all the time, but somebody who's an aggregator that likes to get people around an idea and plan a party. If you can find someone that's living at your values, that's located at your office all the time, and loves to plan parties, I think you're gonna find a really nice solution, even if you're only giving them 5 hours a week or 10 hours a week of responsibility over culture.
Culture has come up a handful of times in these podcasts. I know that especially when we talk with Eric Geiger about different things, just our more topical podcasts, and then when we talk with Brad Lominick about things, culture is just a theme throughout those. And one of the first thing that comes to mind for me when I hear culture, as opposed to like the strategic 5-year plan, for example, is an organization like Apple. You know, you go back and read Steve Jobs' biography. The thing that set Apple apart was not their technology strategy over the long haul, but the culture of creativity and the way that the organization worked. And that's why they thrived to the level they did in such a against such tall odds, I guess, and the competition they face. And so it really is something that it's a buzzword, but it's a buzzword for a reason.
I think that's right. Most buzzwords are, and most cliches are cliches for a reason. They most of the time they actually work. I know, you know, one other thing I've learned about trying to build culture, and we're learning as we go, is, you know, we have a required reading list when you join our firm. And we picked that up from Dave Ramsey. He's taught us so much over the years and is a fantastic client as well. But we have a required reading list, and the reading list is built around cultural values. So like one of the books that we put in there, we have WOW Making Excellence as one of our values. And a book that we read about that is, it's called The New Gold Standard. And it's by the management team at the Ritz-Carlton. And it talks about how they drive culture and a culture of excellence into their organization at all levels. And it's just a fantastic read. But whenever you finally identify what those values are, not just aspirational values that, you know, you'd like to be one day, but what you really are when you're working at your best, if you can build a reading list around those values, it will help new hires get kind of a culture infusion in their first 100 days.
I love that idea. Now I'm a book nut myself, so reading lists always kind of catch my attention. Let's transition to the third question, because I think that it follows neatly on the heels of number two, and that is, what obstacles are you currently facing in leadership, either organizationally, so as a company, or for you personally in growth as a leader?
I think the two are pretty tied together. You know, I really feel called by God to try and build a solution for the Big C Church that will allow the Big C Church to have as good or better a hiring solution than any corporation in the world. And so for me, that's not, I feel called to go do searches. I feel called to build a system and to build a solution. I mean, honestly, story people don't know, but the last thing in the world we wanted to call this firm was my name. I didn't want it to sound like a law firm or, you know, one of the corporate search firms. We bought, I think, like 200 domain names when we launched the firm. It was ridiculous. We were on, I think somebody got a handwritten note from GoDaddy, like, we love you. You buy so many domain names. But we staff the church. We'll find your pastor. You know, we'll build your team, .com.org.biz.us, all the .. And we hired a consultant to say, an SEO search engine optimization consultant to say, okay, most of this is going to happen over the web in the future. So what's the best domain name to make our main one? We'll have everything else point back. So he went out there and he looked at the ones we had. He looked at the ones we didn't have. And he came back and he said, okay, this is going to sound kind of crazy, but William, your last name is so screwed up that you can mistype it about 100 different ways and it'll still Google back to you. So why don't we just make it Vanderblumen? So that's how the name of the firm started. And I hate it because I didn't want this to be about me. I wanted it to be a system that would last. So when you say, what are the challenges that I face personally and that we face as a company, it's the same thing. And we're trying to answer it through my annual review is one question. Did you, William, make yourself less essential to the growth and running of the firm? That's it. That's it. It's a yes, no. And how well did that happen? So every year I'm becoming less essential. Doesn't mean I'm working less. I'm doing different things. Mainly, as Dave Ramsey would say, I work on broken things and new things. And that's pretty much it. But it's the constantly trying to anticipate, to use John Maxwell language, what's the next lid and how do I remove it before we hit it? And for me, that begins and ends with me. I don't need to be the lid. So that's a personal, you know, leadership challenge. And then for us as a staff, there are different things that we look at. What's the next lid in our, we can't use the word sales because churches don't like that word. So like client relations. I know. And I mean, sorry, pastors, it's client relations. It's not really sales, but actually they're very similar. So, you know, how do we build a team out that can personally visit with pastors where they understand that we're not a vendor? We don't see this as some transaction. We see it as a ministry. But at the same time, move them toward saying, yes, let's do this. That's a lid. So we've had to build a team to do that. And it can't hinge on me. How do we build hiring? We have 6 or 7 former executive pastors of very large churches as consultants. And we have some other consultants. But that you can't just go find those forever. So how do you remove that lid? Well, we went and hired Tim Stevens from Granger Church. He's pretty dang good at building systems and developing people, and that's his job. So I think it's two things. How do I make myself less essential, and what's the next lid, and how do I remove it before we get there?
So the ideal is to work your way out of a job because you want to so successfully make yourself unessential by making everything else so successful that they don't need you around anymore.
Well, and I think pastors can find a transferable principle here. One of the ways we know whether I'm doing that or not is, do we get requests for particular consultants to do searches? And right now the answer is not very often. And that's a great thing. Our consultants are great. If they do a great job, we'll send them back to the same client for a new search. But if we're getting, I got to have Deanna doing that search. I got to have, that's not a win. When they're hiring a system, then that's a win. And I think in the church world, you know, the closest thing I see to that is a place like Life Church. Craig is a phenomenal communicator, but that's not what's causing all that growth. It's the systems that are without personality. And it's just, if you can build something like that, man, that's what I would view as success for us. So that's what keeps me up at night and what I'm wrestling with both as a team and individually.
Todd and I and our whole team works closely with churches, and we know that all the talk of systems can make a certain kind of church very uncomfortable because they're, yes, you know, because of their theological bent, because it sounds very non-organic, very lifeless, I guess. And I guess that just to try to sum it up, the kind of system that you are talking about is the kind that actually allows people to build better relationships and do the personal side of ministry more effectively. It doesn't remove the soul or the relational aspect from ministry or in your case, from helping churches. What's that?
It's about intentionality. Yeah. It all comes back to intentionality. It comes back to recognizing what your vision is, your red hot conviction. And then, you know, making sure that you have the constructs, those systems and processes in place. And then, as William has already pointed out, it's that culture is the glue that holds those two things together. It actually, if you have any one of those things out of alignment, you're going to be frustrated or your people are going to be apathetic or, you know, it different ways that it comes out of alignment will manifest itself in different ways. But honestly, I think the big takeaway is that systems and processes are holy. God created a solar system. He created your circulatory system. He's a God of order. And, you know, we all know what happens if the systems in our body get out of whack. I mean, it's a good and godly thing, just like we would say leadership development is not a dirty word. It's a good and godly thing as well. I actually think that I want to kind of harken back to your family life a little bit. So in question number four, what does leadership in your home look like? You've already mentioned that your work life and family life kind of overlap a little bit. And I think that's going to happen more and more in the future. But what does leadership in your home look like right now?
Well, that is a great question. And to give you a little bit of backdrop, Adrian and I have seven children. And so she's amazing. I tell people, that's the best search I've ever done. You know, so
the system worked.
Like, hands down, that's it. I can retire. That's the best search you could ever do. And so our house is kind of lively. We have two that are off in college and then five that are here. And they range from a senior at Texas A&M all the way down to a kindergartner that thinks that she's already graduated from college. So, you know, and then there's the cat and the dog. And so there's always something going on. If you look at Adrian's calendar, it looks like, you know, that 64 color Crayola box. It looks like that because there's just so many different things going on. But what's really interesting about our household is, you know, you have those, we're big believers in at the office and at the house in understanding your personality, not so you know who to hire and fire. I don't ever use a personality test to say yes or no to a hire or fire, but as a communication tool. And in those personality tests, if you're familiar with them, you have a preferred personality and then one that you kind of put on at work. And so your relaxed personality versus your professional personality. And they're usually not, they shouldn't be too far from each other. That's problematic. But I am on the DISC, if you want to use real common language. At work, I'm a pretty high DI. Leadership, get stuff done, and then I love to have a big fun conversation. At home, I'm much more of an ID. Well, what's interesting is, and Adrian and I didn't personality test while we were dating, but she's just the opposite. When we go out when we're at home, she is very much a DC. And in other words, kind of like an engineer or a compliance officer or that sort of thing, which is wonderful for a family of nine people. And it allows me to totally relax on not worrying about having to have every little thing planned because she's right on top of it without me abdicating the role of spiritual leader of the home. So it's a really cool and balanced craziness that happens. We do our devotions together. We're not, you know, I'm not going to be the macho guy that is, you know, always talking about, you know, defer to me. If you've met Adrian, you would know that's really not going to work real well for you. So,
to be fair, that doesn't really work for most people.
I don't think it does.
I was interviewing a candidate a couple years ago, and he lives in Salt Lake City, right? So I had to find a way to kind of give him a little bit of flack for living in Utah. And I said, so, you know, let's move to a different area. Let's not talk about your career the whole time. Let's talk about your life, your personal life. I want to hear about your kids. I want to hear about your pets. I want to hear about all your wives. I want to, you know, and he didn't miss a beat. This must not, he's heard this before. He said, William, the Bible is clear on marriage and how many wives. And I said, oh, really? He said, yes, no man can serve two masters. So yeah, it doesn't work anywhere, but yeah. So home life is really structured, but also with a lot of room for a lot of fun. And we try and view, I talk to parenting experts all the time who have kids that are a mess and you go, wow, what's the incongruency there? So we're not perfect, but we're trying to view, you know, I was told a long time ago, and we say this to each other, parenting is a daily exercise in the art of learning to let go.
Hmm.
And I mean, you know, all we're doing is preparing these people for being adults. That's it. And, you know, we have fun with it and a good home life. But every conversation that we have together about what to do about whatever the thing is that's come up with the kids goes back to how does this equip them for when they're not here anymore? Because having talked to a lot of people, including a lot of counselors, you know, one of the big truths I had never really realized until later in life was, unless something goes weird, you're going to be in relationship with your children as adults far longer than you ever are when they're little. Yeah. So that's just some of the things we're trying to learn how to do right.
Yeah, that's a really interesting perspective, just especially when you see the preponderance of helicopter parenting and the clinginess of many parents, and instead of these the sort of the rocket launcher strategy where you're trying to prep this kid to shoot into the world, that I really like that perspective of the adult relationship lasting many decades longer than the childhood relationship if all goes well. It's really helpful. Well, let's move to our fifth question, and we always get great responses on this one, so I'm excited to hear what you say. And it's, what would you tell your 20-year-old self about preparing to lead? So if you could go back and talk to yourself in your college years, that time frame, and you were going to give yourself just a couple pieces of advice about how to become a leader, what would you say?
Well, the first thing I'd say is you need to stop smoking. I did the prodigal journey.
But you have a lovely voice.
Yeah, right. I quit smoking when I was in college, and I was in a college in a town called Winston-Salem. It was not a fun journey. There are a few cigarettes in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
But yeah, it's yes, one of the key towns on the Tobacco Road.
That's where my wife is from. That's where she grew up.
I actually quit on Ash Wednesday and said I was just going to quit for Lent, right? Just
going to
quit for Lent. And then I'm going to start again. And I actually quit cold turkey. It was 2.5 packs a day. Quit cold turkey and made it all the way through Easter and then said, okay, I'll keep going. And with the exception of one cigarette that I had during an encore, during a Don Henley concert where he came out and got on the drums, I had to have one then. And I think I get a pass for that. Other than that, it's been cold turkey. So if I were talking about 20-year-old self, probably even before the smoking thing, I talked to him about Jesus because I was really far from God then. But if we fast forward a little bit to like maybe the beginning of my professional career, I would have said something along the lines of, you know, the most deadly personality combination is when arrogance and ignorance meet. And I came to First Presbyterian Houston when I was 31 years old, so 5,000 people, 5,000 adults, a couple thousand kids. Oldest church in the city. Sam Houston went to church there. It housed the Texas Senate before the Senate could build a building. And here I was, 31 years old, and the only thing I had going for me was I knew absolutely everything. I was such an arrogant jerk. I don't know how they put up with me. It was just, you know, I've learned my favorite Ted Turner quote, and here it is. If I had a little more humility, I'd be perfect. So
I've never met somebody who said they had a favorite Ted Turner quote.
it's a rare thing. Pride and I have had a lifelong wrestling match, and I've got a pretty good limp from losing a couple rounds. But I would probably say that. I mean, what's the old Ben Franklin quote? I won't get it just right, but the tragedy of life is that we age too quickly and we get wise too slowly. There's just so much that I thought I knew that I didn't. And if I could talk to a 25-year-old me, I'd say slow down and make sure that you're listening more than you're talking. It's still a challenge for me.
My favorite thing about the answers to this last question is that we ask it as if you're giving advice to 20-year-olds, but I'm pretty sure that all of us at any life stage, so I'm sure we have listeners who are in their 50s and 60s, and I'm in my 30s, Todd's in his 30s, that these are answers that we need to hear right now. You know, listen more, talk less, battles with pride. Those things don't actually go away, sadly. We get maybe get better at it, but I find it, I don't know, I love the wisdom that we get from guests and the reminders that we get, so appreciate that. Well, that wraps up this episode. William, thanks so much for coming on with us and taking the time.
Oh, man, it's a total honor. Really appreciate what you guys are doing. And we've had the chance to work with Lifeway in a client relationship a couple of times. And I just have had more fun watching what's going on at Lifeway. People don't know, and you guys are humble and don't talk about it, but the change for the good that's happening there right now is pretty amazing. And I'm out around churches quite a bit, and I'm hearing a buzz. There's a good thing going on there, and you guys are doing a good work.
Well, that is so good to hear.
Yeah,
it's been great to watch over. I've been there for 3 years. I think Barnabas has been there for a year and a half, 2 years. And it's been great to watch people come in from, I mean, almost everybody that works there worked at a local church. And unless you miss working at a local church on a weekly basis, unless it's painful for you not to be at a local church, we don't want you. And that's I think that's a key part of the culture. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's becoming more and more successful in an arena that isn't always doing the best right now. You know, publishing is not something that everyone is rushing to get into these days. And yet we're still finding growth in that and still finding a way to serve churches.
Well, thanks so much to everybody for listening to this episode of the Five Leadership Questions podcast. Our guest was William Vanderblumen, and if you go to vanderblumen.com, you can find both their blog, which is just full of practical leadership and church leadership wisdom. They get contributions from their whole staff, and it's a fantastic resource. I use it regularly and share the links through Ministry Grid's feed and our site. So, and then the Vanderblumen Leadership Podcast, which if you like listening to this podcast, you will love listening to that podcast as well. So check both of those out. Also, if you haven't yet, jump on iTunes, leave us a rating and a review, preferably a kind one, but we're not that picky. Thanks so much for listening, and tune in next time.
Thank you for listening to the Five Leadership Questions podcast. To learn more about how you can train leaders in your church, visit ministrygrid.com/howitworks and watch a short demo video. For participating, you will get a free 30-day trial for your entire church. Again, that's ministrygrid.com/howitworks.